Welcome to How'd You Think of That with Temple Grandin, Season 2. I'm your co-host, Sherry Quinn.
Hi, I'm Temple Grandin, Professor of Animal Science at Colorado State University. I work in animal behavior, also designing lots of equipment for livestock.
We seek out innovators, educators, and researchers who approach challenges with their own unique abilities, such as the way Temple Grandin uses visual thinking to approach problems and discover solutions. On our first episode in the series, titled Cybersecurity 360, it's everywhere and everything.
Convenience and cybersecurity don't go together.
Joining us is Dr. Diego Tibaquira.
I'm Dr. Diego Tibaquira, and I'm a professor at Miami-Dade College, computer science, cybersecurity, and cloud computing. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Diego grew up in the Bronx in New York. After pursuing a degree in civil engineering for 2.5 years, he dropped out of college and joined the Marines, where he served 8 years.
My job in the Marines was related to computers. While in the Marines, I went back to school and kind of got back on track to be able to attend school. I went to University of North Carolina at Greensboro, North Carolina A&T, got a bachelor's and master's in computer science. And my master's, the National Security Agency had a program. They were trying to recruit new people. So they kind of gave me a stipend to go to school with the promise that I would go work for them once I graduated. So from North Carolina, I moved to Washington, D.C. I worked for the Department of Defense. I worked for the National Security Agency. And at that time is when I got into what is now called cybersecurity. A couple of years into that, an opportunity came to come to Miami and teach at Miami-Dade College. And the idea was to help Miami-Dade College build a cybersecurity program. So that's where I've been ever since. I have been here in Miami teaching computer science. In the past 5 years, we were able to get grant funding and the proper things in place that now we have a very robust cybersecurity program and cloud computing program to the point that now we're one of the standards in the nation in cybersecurity for the 2 and 4 year colleges. You know, we've been all over. We've been to Israel. We've been presenting in conferences, talking to other colleges, trying to help them now establish what we did.
Well, I tried computer programming. It didn't work for me, but one of the things I want to talk about is how a visual thinker like me, who's very bad in math, is needed in computer security. A little later in the conversation, I'll give you some examples of why you need a person like me who cannot do higher math.
Perfect.
Microsoft and the AACC, American Association of Community Colleges, picked Miami-Dade as one of 14 colleges to help lead the nation in cybersecurity. The college offers certificates and an associate degree in science in cybersecurity that was launched in 2019 and is one of the most popular degrees at Miami-Dade. The bachelor's degree in computer science was launched in the spring of 2021, and they've already had at least 18 graduates.
It's a needed field, but it's something that we created. We use different perspectives. We took the National Security Agency as a standard. They have something called knowledge units, what every computer science cybersecurity program should have. So we looked at that and built on it. We do industry certifications to help our students get ahead. So not just get a degree, but get an industry certification, pad those resumes. I have helped over 250 students get certified in the past 5 years.
Diego says it takes about 2 years for a course or program to be approved by the state, and says they work with more than a dozen business and industry leaders to learn what they want in a graduate.
So we kind of took all those different pieces and put them in place to create a really robust program that will produce great students. But the next piece that people don't think about when creating programs is, are they going to get hired? So all those other things that I mentioned on top of that degree are getting our students hired, which is the bottom line, the biggest thing, graduate and get a job. But our students are working, getting internships, apprenticeships, and jobs in many different companies now.
That's wonderful that you got to get students hired. That's something I'm really interested in too. Now I want to talk about a visual thinker's view of computer security. I do a lot of talks, and I do a lot of talks to big corporations. And I always make sure that the host has my PowerPoint slides. And how do I get them into them? I send it to their home Gmail address. They put it either on a stick or on a laptop that's walked through the firewall. So the host has my slides, because I've had many times where bigcorporation.com, if I don't have that email address, I can't get into a Zoom call. And bigcomputercompany.com, I'm going to leave all the names out of all these things. They got my PowerPoint walked in, and then I couldn't get on the Zoom or Microsoft Teams or whatever it was. And so what we did is we took my phone, held it up to my ear, and I called them. And the host put the phone on speaker, his phone on speaker, and put it next to his mic. And I had a paper copy of my slides. I have done major presentations to major computer companies and major universities with this phone patch. And I've taught a lot of people how to do it. Now, another thing that I'm seeing happening, and I don't think it's very good for security, is Gmail ecosystems. Okay, if you're old, the AOL ecosystems or whatever, personal email systems forming all around these big corporations. I've done cattle conferences with bigcorporation.com, and I asked them why they were using, they're not using their corporate email. You cannot send any attachments. So to get my PowerPoint in, I have to send it to their home computer. Now, here's two other things that concerns me about security. I went to a factory 2 years ago. I can't tell you what kind of factory it is, except it was in the US. I keep everything confidential. That's my security. And we're walking around in this factory, and I find a computer, something you might buy at Best Buy, a flat screen monitor sitting on a chair, a keyboard sitting on a chair, the boxes under the chair. And I said, why have you got this computer here? It was brand new, on a chair. And they said, well, there's certain piece of equipment we can't control from the control room. I don't think the Wi-Fi was disabled on that computer. And then even more scary, at an airport somewhere in the US, I was walking onto the electric train and I looked up at the sign that's supposed to just tell me where it's going. And a message came up on that sign saying there was an additional IP address on this network. That should be totally isolated from the internet. Let's look at something you can't do virtual. I can tell you what I've got to do. Go to that airport, and I'm going to have to go down into the catacombs underneath the airport where they have a little maintenance office, find the guy who will sing to me and tell me everything. Got to protect my sources here. Yeah. They will tell you everything.
Convenience and cybersecurity don't go together. And so Temple's examples were people trying to have convenience without thinking of the cybersecurity effects of that convenience. And then you got to do both. Okay, it's convenient. Now I can see it from oh, wow, the trains are down. Oh, wow, somebody hacked us. That's because I opened up a port so I could see it from my house.
That's the kind of stuff that would have happened. And I've got also another thing. You need somebody who probably has autism that loves that train more than anything else in the world. Because someone who loves that train is going to keep it running. And this brings into another thing about autism. I know people that, you know, that take care of big pumps, waterworks, all kinds of things. And the most important thing in their life would be to keep that train safe and operating, to keep electrical systems operating, to keep all kinds of industrial equipment working. It's like their plant. They'll put pictures of the plant up on the wall. It's their baby. And we need those people too. So as a visual thinker, there's a point where I almost think maybe you need to have two layers of security. Okay, for bigcorporation.com, the R&D department, that has to be really secure. Employee social security number stuff, that has to be super secure. But you're planning a conference with outsiders? Maybe that needs to be a different level of security.
Yeah, so some companies do have that extra level of security. The problem with cybersecurity nowadays, the more complex you make the security, the less convenient. I don't think there is a mechanism in place, but segregating pieces of the network, you know, separating the different areas, that tends to be a big issue. But you mentioned ICS, the industrial control systems. That's something that we're working on. A lot of industrial control systems are older. Legacy systems.
Yep, they are. I have a good friend that works on them.
Yeah. That's a big issue that we're running into. They do not have the capability to even provide security to them. So that's one. The other thing that we found is replacing some of these systems is very, very costly. So it is not cost effective. And they say, you know, we know the risk, but we would prefer to, you know, continue doing business until
way to reduce the risk. Yeah. And I'm a mechanical person. So if the computer tells the piece of equipment to spin too fast, which would wreck it, an old-fashioned system, non-electronic, will shut it down. Tell something to get too hot or to get too much pressure, old-fashioned mechanical controls will shut it down. If the computer tells it to operate in a way that would break the system, that's what I would do. Okay, so to prevent something blowing up, you put pressure relief valve on it, mechanical one, hacker proof. I can't control against sabotage inside the factory, but I can make sure that nobody outside the factory could do something to it.
And you just use the word hacker because that's what we're protecting against. How do we protect all these systems? How do we protect, you know, our power plants? How do we protect our water supply?
A Florida city's water supply was hacked in February 2021. The hacker gained remote access to a dormant software that was still on the treatment plant's system and upped the levels of sodium hydroxide, or lye, to dangerous levels. An operator saw the mouse cursor clicking through the plant's controls and reversed it, but there was another safeguard in place.
So when the phantom arrow was clicking to put more chemicals into the water supply than it should have, the size of the pipe prevented it from going suddenly into the system. That's a mechanical control.
And I was just going to mention that one, because that one is one very common that we use as an example.
Yeah.
So it's something that we're working on in the cybersecurity side, just to revamp the industrial control systems across the nation on every single major manufacturing corporation is going to take another taking. I think it's necessary, but you also walk into many corporations that are like, we don't have the budget, or we don't have the manpower, or they're going with the risk.
The other thing is I visualize risk. You're probably computing risk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put mechanical controls on that equipment because I'm going to assume the computer's going to get hacked. And if that computer tells that piece of equipment to operate in a mode that would make it destruct, my mechanical controls will shut the whole system down.
Stop it. Yeah.
Old-fashioned controls, stuff from the 50s.
And the thing with nowadays, especially with the TV systems, you put a TV in a conference room, and if it's one of the smart TVs, the smart TV needs an IP, and if you put an IP and that smart TV is not protected the same way as everything else on the network, we have had cases that corporations have been hacked through a smart TV because the smart TV has an IP address, and through that IP address, you can then access. So just the example that you're giving. So the problem is, again, technology is great, but if not done properly, it can be very dangerous. But Internet of Things, you know, gives you the capability of turning on your lights, turning off your, you know, turning on your car, doing all these things.
I don't have any of that stuff. I don't have any of that stuff, and I never will.
Yeah, without the proper cybersecurity in place, any and every of one of these devices could be used to attack. So,
well, anything, there's no way I'm going to have a computerized anything to control something with a heating element, like a coffee pot or a heater that could burn something up. There's no way, absolutely no way. And then I assume this computer spies on me, so I'll always get undressed upstairs.
And you're doing good because the newer generation are living more into the, you know, we want everything automated. The refrigerator will send you or even send directly to the supermarket a message saying, you know, I need these items because they're running low. And then you pass by, you pick them up and you go. Or even the supermarket will deliver it without you even having to do anything. So
there's somebody drains your bank account. And I'll tell you, I'm super old fashioned. I use two airline credit cards for all my on the road. They're not on the same bank, and paper bills. I will use them until I'm forced to change that.
Yeah.
And then if I'm forced, I'm going to set up a rubbish account on a different bank will go in the dirt. Let's put it that way.
But I think you and I have been around long enough. We were here before all this was here, so we understand the security and the way it was secure. But the younger generation, the 90s, the 2000s, they don't see it that way. They see the convenience.
Yeah, I can see the new world. I can see the convenience, but I wouldn't want to lose my life savings.
At what cost? And they don't understand that part. So how would you convince somebody from this generation? How would I convince my students to do what you just said, to not, you know, do everything digital when they grew up in that?
It's one thing, okay, if a camera spied on you, make sure I've got some places I can do bathe and get dressed that don't have cameras. And the other thing to do on the online shopping would be just get a debit card that you just fill that's not on my bank. And if someone hacked that, maybe they get a few $100 out of it. Can't get in my savings account. My default setting is it will be hacked and everything's a scam. I don't give out any credit card information. I only donate to charities that I know. Everything, all the other phone solicitations, it's scam. That's my default setting.
And what some credit card companies are starting to do is you can create temporary credit card numbers that is not your credit card number, but it's something that they give you just to do that transaction with that entity. There are ways to you know, help protect your life on the digital world, but something that is not very common is you don't see advertisement towards that. You don't see, you know, encouragement for, so you're in it. You're in it because of your feel and what you do and the work that you do. You understand it. But most of the regular, some of my students that are cybersecurity students, when I talk about all these things, it's like the first time they hear it. And they're getting into the cybersecurity field. So the common regular user is still not being taught in that way. And I understand it's a marketing perspective, because if Temple wants to buy something and we make it so hard that you got to get a new credit card number, Temple might go to another website. Or Temple might just not buy it.
Half the stuff you buy, you don't need anyway. When we had all of the supply chain problems, the shipping containers and things like that, and shipping containers got to $20,000 a box, I thought half the stuff in those shipping containers you don't need. It's all this clothing, big waste. And also, having worked in industry, I understand mechanical equipment. And so I actually totally understand the mechanical controls I can put on pieces of equipment so the computer cannot command it to destroy itself.
How do we get that to the regular everyday user in a way that they understand and are able to utilize some of those techniques? In 2021, I had a cybersecurity bootcamp for high school teachers that are teaching cybersecurity. One of the teachers stayed with me after class to tell me how he was scammed by one of these phone calls that says, hey, your password is not working. I need to take control of your computer.
He said yes.
He kept on going to the point when he realized they had taken $4,000 off his computer. This is a teacher that teaches cybersecurity at the high school level. So if he can get hacked, anybody can get hacked. And that's the biggest issue that we're running into. And you don't see, again, as much advertisement, you know, on TV and everywhere else. So my conversations, my presentations, everything is how to do that, how to protect yourselves better. Cybersecurity for all is my next thing, in which cybersecurity is not just for the students, for the programs and everything I'm doing at the college, but every single person needs to understand cybersecurity from our kids to, you know, everybody else, because a point of entry could be anywhere. Anyone and any device, and you don't protect everything that you just spoke about, it makes it a vulnerability. So how do we minimize those?
Well,
so
I just assume, the other thing, I assume everything online is public, period. Every device that has a camera or a microphone and can spy on me.
So it's safe to say that you don't have an Alexa?
No, I don't.
And so
I don't have any automation of any kind. And if I had an Alexa, she'd be downstairs. And when I had to do private conversations, they'd be upstairs. And if you want to do the super secure private conversation, it'll be on my old landline that I still have.
Yes. So my first conversation to my students is privacy. We're living in a world of zero privacy, and they don't understand that.
That's right.
No privacy. So they enhance that by putting everything on social media. So Instagram and Facebook and what I eat, when I eat it. Where do I go? They don't understand that a picture that you take and post it to social media, unless you remove the geolocation, the picture has the exact coordinates of where that picture was taken.
Oh, I know that.
You go on vacation and you post, you know, I'm going away on vacation. You're just telling somebody, hey, my house is empty and there's nobody in there, just in case you want to pass by and go inside. Getting people to understand that. So we love, or people love, the social media, the interaction, but they don't understand that there are some concerns in there. And again, students of cybersecurity tend to be like, oh, I didn't know. I didn't think of it that way. So again, how do we get people to understand that they do need a certain level of privacy? The next thing is, anything and everything you do, you're saying, not just being watched, but this conversation is going through different routers. So my house has to go through an internet service provider that will give us the internet service. And, you know, the three of us have doing the same. Every single one of those internet service providers by law has to keep track of what goes through their servers. And the reason for that is, if from Cherry's home, something happens and an attack occurs, not that Cherry did it, but somebody got into her, you know, internet and use her Wi-Fi to launch an attack, they have to have those records in order for them to backtrack and be able to pinpoint in that sense. They might knock on your door and you're like, I had no idea. They go into your router and it's like, look, it came through this connection, because it's not something that we see, you know, unless you have ever gone into your router and you lock, you know, some of those ports and I have only 10 connections available and I know what are the devices that are connected. But most people don't know that. The other thing is every Wi-Fi connection at home now has a username or a password, at least. You have an SSID which identifies your network and you can change it. And then it has a password. And then through that, they can get into your network. A couple of years back, they didn't come with passwords. It would be automatically to get in. And that's how your neighbor will get into your Wi-Fi and anybody passing by. But we understood that. So now companies are forcing it. So a lot of these things are being forced. You either put a weak password or no password at all. And so in that sense, you see how it's just everybody. Everybody needs to understand. Now, from the pandemic, a couple of things that I like is that a lot of people got to understand more how computer systems work and the word VPN, a private network that you could use to connect and more secure. So I like that, you know, but now we're going away from the pandemic and people are starting to forget those basics that they learned through that. And then we're coming right back into it because you want a more, not secure, but you want a more convenient system. You want a system that you just go to the website, buy something, and then that's it. You don't want the complexity of
multi-factor
authentication and putting a code and a pen and getting your phone. The one last thing I wanted to mention is, because you mentioned you do a lot of stuff through your phone. My conversation in the past couple of things is, my phone has more capacity than maybe my laptop. I do most of my work from my phone. So I have an antivirus protector. I have certain security things in place on my phone to have it protected. I have remote wipe and all those things. Most people do not have anything to protect their phones, and they do everything through their phones. And then they download games in which nobody has ever read an agreement, which tells you that you, in order to download a game, they're gonna take, they can go to your pictures, camera. So like you said, turning something on, they can turn on your camera, they can turn on your video, they can do all that stuff. So our phones right now are a single point of failure that if they take a, you know, charge of your phone, they can actually can take charge of your entire life, because you, a lot of people do.
And across the world, hackers are stealing enormous amounts of data from governments, companies, hospitals, and other organizations, holding them hostage.
And every time it happens, they call me. Ransomware is when one of these threat actors, bad actors, takes control over your system and asks for a certain amount of money if you want to get it back. It has become a big problem because it comes from the states where we don't have jurisdiction. So we cannot, even if we know, I know where Cherry is, but Cherry lives in Russia. I cannot go and knock on Cherry's door and, you know, take her away because I don't have jurisdiction over some of the islands in the Caribbean. We don't have jurisdiction over those. So most of these things happen from overseas. So what is the impact? Last year, so I'm a runner. I run marathons and all that stuff. So I have a Garmin watch. And for 2 days, my Garmin watch was not connecting to my phone. And I was wondering what happened. And what happened was Garmin got hacked with ransomware. And I think they paid $10 million to get their information back. Now, paying is the easiest way to go about it. And you want to pay without letting anybody know because, you know, your reputation can be damaged. You can lose customers. All these things can happen. But the more and more ransomware is happening, what the FBI is telling them is not to pay. FBI is telling people not to pay. Do not pay. Call us and then we'll, you know, try to work. But at that point, people is going to find out that your corporation got hacked, that, you know, somehow your cybersecurity wasn't strong enough and it allowed a threat actor. So right now, ransomware is costing about $6.2 billion in damages. And then people, the biggest damage that they don't want to occur is their name be thrown out there, that there was a big ransomware and you didn't know how to protect it. So that's one of the biggest things. There's a lot of money. Recently, people have stopped paying, contact the FBI. The FBI gets involved. And one of the latest ransomware, and ransomware gets paid through Bitcoin, which is the big, everything is digital. So the paper check doesn't exist on that world. So Bitcoin, they get paid. The FBI was able to get 75% of the last ransom that was paid. So that we're making moves into counteracting this, but ransomware is one of the biggest risks nowadays. Now, we all three might say, well, I have never been ransomware. I have never, well, because we don't have anything. You know, they're not going to attack us. They usually go for the bigger corporations where they can get $10 million, $5 million. Biggest thing with the ransomware, when you go in and you get attacked and you get a screen on your computer that says, hey, you cannot access because we have taken over, they have an entire customer service department built in. That you call an 800 number, and that 800 number, there will be somebody there on the other side, the nicest people in the world, telling you this is how much, how you're going to pay. Okay. Oh, yes, the payment is here. Okay. The problem with that is they did it once. What is going to stop them to do it again? That's the only reason why the FBI doesn't want people to pay ransomware. It's one of the biggest threats in the things that we're doing in the world that we're living in right now. And everybody knows about ransomware. The next one is identity theft has become more rampant. And these numbers are incredible. So I think Target lost $120 million customer information. Experian, you know, the one that, of the three credit bureaus, lost about 150 million, customer information. And how that happens and how that affects the regular user. So for those companies, they end up big settlement cases. They have to pay back millions of dollars. To us, the regular users, I think my Experian thing was like $10 I would get because there's so many users, they would have to pay so much money, but they're losing a lot of money in that sense. The United States has one of the worst privacy laws in order to protect us. So Cherry, you wanted to know where your information is right now in the United States, what servers, who's using it, what are they using it for, and all that stuff. It would be almost impossible to do that. And can you tell them to take your information down? It would be really hard. And the way we do business in the US, Cherry has a business. You say, I would not sell your information. I'm going to collect it all. Okay. But then tomorrow, Cherry sells that company to somebody else. And one of the things they do is sell information. At that point, that supersedes whatever previous agreement. And data is one of the biggest businesses in the world right now. In that sense, we have a couple of really tough things going on that are becoming really hard now. The European Union has GDPR, and the privacy laws are a lot better. If Cherry contacted an entity and said, I want to know what you have on me, they have to provide it to you within a day or two. And once you read it, you say, I don't want this information to be on your servers anymore. Please remove it. They have 2 or 3 days to get rid of your information automatically. No questions asked. The privacy goes with the individual. In the US, the corporations.
Okay, there was a big hack of one of our major meat companies. We'll leave the name off. And it totally screwed up all of their truck scheduling for incoming livestock and outgoing product. It screwed up their machine for all their computer system for labeling meat. And it also erased all the contacts off of personal cell phones of the employees that had bigcorporation.com email in it. And I think what a lot of companies need to do is have some contingency plans, like backup programs that run industrial equipment on sticks and lock them up in somebody's home somewhere in a very secure place. One of the ways you can do the orders, and this is what this company had to do when their system got hacked and it was a big ransomware thing, and they managed to get some of the Bitcoin back, is just to deliver what you delivered last week. And maybe use the printer a little bit more. And what did they do about the labels? Well, they got together with FedEx and some other stuff, and they made the label. I mean, you could put a handwritten label on a piece of meat. That's legal. But on things involving food, power, water, let's have some contingency plans so you can go offline if you have to. But really important stuff. There's more important than a lot of the dumb stuff people do online. You want water. You want power. You want food.
The other term that has been thrown around is the supply chain. Yes. But people don't understand that something like that is what affects the supply chain. Because at that point, you're not able to meet your deadlines to send stuff, to distribute stuff. And then
well,
at
that
point... that's
the problem. Now, you see, when as a visual thinker, supply chain is not abstract.
No.
I mean, I work in the meat industry. And I can visualize every step of that supply chain. I have been over to China and seen how to watch them load the ships. And I can actually visualize the entire supply chain. One of the big problems I'm finding with a lot of supply chain officers that don't think in pictures is they don't even know how their supply chain works. I've been kind of shocked at this. You see, this is where we need the different kinds of minds. Engineers calculate risk. I see risk. And we need to work together, but have some kind of contingency plan that if this system goes down, we can get the stuff we really need, food, power, water, stuff that really matters.
Yeah, and you touch on the point that maybe even the supply manager or chain supply manager or person that's in charge of doing that doesn't even understand the complexity of it from beginning to end. And you have to know from beginning to end what are all the different pieces and where can it break, because it can break at any point. And once you're backed up by, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, you cannot just stop. You cannot just stop. So having that visual of beginning to end, it just makes an entire difference into how do you protect each one of those links. And people don't understand that supply link change is just a bunch of links, because it goes from here to here to here. Anything can happen.
To help prepare a workforce that can handle these problems, Diego says programs at colleges like Miami-Dade are building a pipeline, one that starts building cybersecurity skills starting at the high school level.
We will do summer boot camps in cybersecurity and then hopefully trying to get them into, you know, our college for the programs. Then we went to the high school teachers. And last year I did a boot camp for the high school teachers to teach them, you know, all this information and relating to cybersecurity. So for us, it's a pipeline now that has been built from high school to college to career, alumni, getting jobs. And more across the nation, we're seeing that manufacturing and cybersecurity manufacturing is becoming, you know, a really big element into what we're doing. Just from the way that Temple just explained it, it's not only going in and working the machine, but, you know, what are the things that can break it? And in the past, the things that can break it could be just human error. You know, you go in there and put the wrong screw or something like that, or you didn't tie it enough. But now, since it's connected to the network, something from the network can also break that machine. And how do we do that? So manufacturing, we don't do manufacturing at our college, but a lot of colleges that we work with do the manufacturing programs. And that's what they're, you know, teaching to their students as well, so that they understand the process of how to properly secure it, not only from a physical attack, but like a digital attack as well.
There is also an effort to start teaching cybersecurity even earlier to elementary school students.
The other things that we're looking into cybersecurity is the Girl Scouts. The Girl Scouts have now a cybersecurity badge. So I have two little ones. There's third and fourth grade. But last year when they were in second, third grade, I was invited to go to their school. And one of the things that I talked to the kids was security online and then cyberbullying and all that stuff. Because if you become much better aware at a younger age, once you get to these places where Temple was talking about and working, at that point, you're going to have a better understanding. And that's why cybersecurity for all, you know, I tell people cybersecurity is 360 degrees. It's everywhere and it's everything. So it's just starting very early. So our pipeline starts in high school. Other people are going down to the middle schools. I do presentations to my girls' schools, but that's just me as the father. But some people give a tablet to or a computer to their kids just so that they entertain themselves without much thinking. You tell your kids not to talk to strangers, right? We all grew up with that. But you don't tell your kids not to talk to strangers on the internet. Because on the internet, you feel safe because that stranger is not right in front of you. The worst thing is they're getting into the applications that their students are using. So Duolingo is an application to learn another language. People are using that to talk to kids. Now we're trying to go all the way back to elementary school, middle school, high school, and college, of course. But we're trying to go as far back. You think about it, my daughters grew up in an entirely digital world. Their world will be digital for their entire lives from beginning. So understanding the security of it. So I will just share one last thing. Our computer systems were using microchips that came from China.
Well, I know that.
And so the federal government just passed regulation that none of the DoD systems can have any equipment that comes from outside the US. It makes sense from the beginning. I didn't even think they were using it.
Yeah. But
you know, when we go to cost, what is more cost effective? Well, we're going to use microchips that cost less, but that microchip that comes from China might have something in it that we don't want, that is going to you know, send out all the information or whatever that system is supposed to be doing. And how somebody didn't think of that. And Temple wasn't in that room to tell him, hey, you're not thinking about, you know, the overall picture. You're just thinking about this one thing.
Let's look at stuff we don't make. Structural glass walls at the Apple mothership building. They came from Italy and Germany. That's because they kept the hands-on classes. The state-of-the-art machine that makes the tiniest little tiny, super sophisticated electronic chips is from Holland. There's stuff that we don't make. We are paying the price for taking a shop class. You want a poultry processing plant right now? You're going to have to get it in 100 shipping containers from Holland. Now you're going to have problems because they cut off the gas supply and they shut down the steel mills. Big supply chains, very, very fragile. Is another thing. A big supply chain, and there's a single chip factory, and you know where it is. I don't do any politics, but if this particular chip factory goes down, we're in a pile of trouble. If you have a more distributed supply chain, it's going to be more expensive, but it doesn't break as easy because you've got more than one source. I don't care what it is, whether it's meat, whether it's electronic chips. Big is not bad. It's fragile. That's the problem.
And people don't think about that. People don't think about that. So
I did think about that.
Yeah, no, but in general, the people that are designing it, creating it, and putting it into practice are the ones that are not thinking about that and should. But something as simple as somebody asking me, hey, so I have a antivirus in my phone, but it comes from Russia. What should I do? I said, you should uninstall it, but they already have all your information. So it's not just the solution, but the right solution to the problem that we need to have. And we need to have everybody get into this mindset that all of us, you know, are part of that cybersecurity world in which we help our world be better protected. But again, it starts with small things. But when you have the social media conglomerate dealing the way that they do, and then again, something as simple as multi-factor authentication that you know, you use your username, password, and a ping is sent to your phone, that just gave you an extra layer that you are the person that you say you are. But I don't think we're transmitting that information in the right way. So I am to my students, but these are cybersecurity students. But the regular user needs to understand this.
Well, I think the most important thing the regular user needs to understand is nothing's private.
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing
Absolutely
is
nothing.
Private.
Nothing. All right, I do have to go.
Okay, I have to go too.
Have a great day.
Great to talk to you. I've got to get out in the car right now and get rolling.
That was Diego Tibaquita and Temple Grandin. Thank you for listening. I'm Sherry Quinn.
You can hear episodes at stem.utah.gov/podcast. How'd You Think of That is a production of the STEM Action Center in partnership with SQ Productions. This podcast is based upon material supported by the National Science Foundation under grant 174-5674.